This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For years, we've been hearing about this nation's obesity epidemic. North Carolina reports that two-thirds of all adults in the state are overweight or obese. States around the country, including this one, have instituted programs designed to prevent and reverse obesity by helping people develop better eating and exercise habits. It all sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, not to everyone. Fat activism is a growing movement of overweight people who say it is possible to be both fat and healthy. And they say these programs can lead to unfair discrimination in the workplace, at school, even in medicine. And we're going to talk about this with one of the people who feels that way. Reagan Chastain is a leading fat activist blogger. Her blog, DancesWithFat.com, insists that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are not size-dependent. And she joins us by phone from Los Angeles, where it's very early in the morning. So thank you for being here. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Here in our studio is someone who probably has a slightly different point of view, an exercise physiologist. Dr. Scott Gordon is chair of the Department of Kinesiology at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Happy to be here. Nice to have you with us. And joining us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio, Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, is one of our past guests, Michael Buchanan. Michael was with us a few years ago to talk about the impact of being fat and what it was doing to children in school. He wrote a book and made a film that told the true story of a young man struggling with his weight and being picked on in the process. The book and the film, which, by the way, is now available on Netflix, are called The Fat Boy Chronicles. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Reagan, what is fat activism? It sounds like a pejorative term, and I want to make sure that people understand that it's actually a term that you use. But what is it?
So fat activism is about really two parts. The first part is fat acceptance, which is the idea that fat people have the right to exist in fat bodies without shame or stigma or bullying, that people get to prioritize their health in different ways, that people get to go after health in different ways is the second part, which is health at every size. The idea that healthy habits are our best chance at a healthy body rather than trying to reach a specific body size and calling that the pursuit of health.
And would you describe this as a movement, as a trend? Are you the leading standard bearer in this, or are there others? How many others? Give me an idea of how big this all is.
Oh, there are thousands of us. The movement has been going on since the 60s. That's when the first organization started, the National Association for the Advancement of Fat Acceptance. There's also the Association for Size Diversity and Health, the Size Diversity Task Force, the Fatosphere, which is our name for within the blogosphere, bloggers who blog and discuss these topics, whether it's fat activism, health at every size, or both. It's a large movement of people who are, you know, getting louder and stronger and demanding their rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
On your blog, danceswithfat.com, you write, "I started blogging when I realized that there were people who believed that if they couldn't get skinny, they should hate themselves, and people who had never moved their bodies for any reason other than to try to change the size and shape of their bodies. You, however, do move your body. You're a dancer. You're a choreographer. Would you describe yourself as fat?"
Oh, I'm absolutely fat. And it's interesting because people will say to me, "Oh, you're not fat." And I'm almost 300 pounds. There's no question that I'm fat. And when they say, you know, "You're not fat," what they're trying to say is, "You're not all of the stereotypes about fat people that I hold or that society holds." Right? Now, and so they try to make it a pejorative rather than simply a neutral descriptor, like I'm also short and brunette.
Okay. So now, if you're overweight, if you're fat, do you consider yourself overweight?
Overweight is a tricky term, like over what weight?
Okay.
I eat well, I exercise quite a bit. That's just how I, you know, happen to choose to live my life. It's not better or worse than people who want to do something else, like knit with their time. But overweight is not a term that I'd use to describe myself. I much prefer fat.
Okay, so you're fat, and you admit to your fat, you're 300 pounds, but you exercise, you dance, you are a choreographer. How did this happen?
Actually, in high school, developed an eating disorder. Was quite sick, ended up being hospitalized, an under eating disorder. And in the hospital, I started to gain quite a bit of weight. And so while being treated for an eating disorder, I was also being told by doctors that I had to lose weight to be healthy. And so they put me on a ton of diets over a period of years. And I had what I later found was the experience that almost everybody has. I would lose weight in the beginning, and then regardless of how much I stayed to the diet, I would gain weight. The weight back over time, plus extra weight. And my weight continued to go up until I started to practice health at every size, when I started to do the research and realized that none of these diets had any evidentiary basis. Like, there was no study where people went on a diet and the majority of them lost weight and kept it off long term. The study just didn't exist. And so I found health at every size that said, which seems so clear now, oh, well, if you know, knowing that health is multidimensional, knowing that it's not entirely within our control ever, our best chance at our best odds for health is to practice healthy habits. And when I started doing that, my weight leveled off and it's been stable for years. But until then, it just kept, you know, I was dieting and I was in this cycle, you know, this weight cycling or yo-yo dieting where I'd lose weight and then gain it back plus more, lose weight and then gain it back plus more, which I found, you know, again, based on the research, is what happens to almost everybody.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Gordon, you're an exercise physiologist, a kinesiologist. You study the movement and exercise of people. Is it unusual for somebody like a dancer? And I've seen her dance. She can move. Is it unusual for somebody like that to be, as she self-describes herself, fat?
Actually, no, especially these days. And you look at a lot of former athletes who have been physically active in their younger days and were used to being—
But she still is active.
Very healthy, yes. And so she still is active, which is very commendable because at any weight, you can improve your health by being physically active. That's a very important point that she brings up. You don't want to just be complacent about your weight. You want to make healthy choices. It's not all about weight. There are still data out there that show the leaner you are, the more weight you – if you can lose weight, it'll make you healthier in a lot of ways. But if that's a difficulty for you, at least remain active, at least maintain a healthy diet, and you can improve your health status regardless of weight loss. So it's an important point, and Reagan's to be commended for that.
I was thinking about this yesterday, and I'd like to hear your point of view on this, Reagan, and also, Michael, yours, because you wrote the Fat Boy Chronicles and you've produced a film about it, and it's a true story. In thinking about this yesterday, I thought I'm going to have to use the word fat a lot. And it sounds like a pejorative term, whereas if I looked at somebody and said, you know, you're skinny, I wouldn't feel bad about that. I would never say to somebody, you're fat, but I would say to somebody, you're skinny. So how do you view the word fat, Reagan?
I view it as a neutral descriptor. You know, I'm fat, I'm short, I'm brunette. And to me, it's also a bit of a reclaiming term. It's one of the ways that I tell the bullies that they can't have my lunch money anymore, that my body is just too amazing to trash talk it, to talk bad about it, to let it be stigmatized and bullied without answering back. And so using the word fat is important to me, and it's also simple.
Okay. Michael, because you did this story about this young boy who was in school at the time. How did he view the word fat?
Actually, the book and the movie are inspired by a true story.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That a kid that we met at a book signing a bunch of years ago who had walked up to us, and he looked very healthy and the right weight, and he told us that we need to write his story. So that's how it got going. But as we started to think about the title for the book specifically, having the word fat in there created some issues. And we had parents that say, well, gosh, I don't know if I can give my kid a book that has the word fat in there. They might feel uncomfortable. But in talking with doctors at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta and Cincinnati Children's, they said part of the problem with many parents or with society is that we don't just go ahead and call it like it is, and then we can start to deal with the problem however it manifests itself.
Mm.
And so the word fat stayed in the title.
Well, you know, when I was in my 20s, I had a 28-inch waist. I don't anymore. And I look at myself sometimes and I say, you're fat. And I think of that as being a bad thing. And I think that goes through society, doesn't it?
Actually, it's pretty universal for most people the older they get. their lean body mass or muscle mass will absolutely decline. Their percent body fat will increase. The statistics we use in most of our health data to define fatness or define obesity is the body mass index, which is probably not the best indicator, but it's an easy indicator, and that's why it's caught hold.
Because, Michael, the subject of your movie and your book, The Fat Boy Chronicles, was bullied because he was overweight in school. I'm told that he has since shed those pounds. He's gone on to get married. He's at what society views as a normal body weight. What led him to lose that weight, and what is, in his mind, a normal body weight?
I would guess normal for him would just be something that he feels comfortable with. But in his own journey, Doug, the kid who lives in Cincinnati, or did at the time, decided, having gone to his doctor, that he wanted to lose weight. I mean, that was his motivating factor, because he felt like the doctor actually never told anybody about all the bullying and how difficult it was, and he had suicidal thoughts on these things. And yet he just kind of unloaded on his doctor. He had the spring of his eighth grade year. And that summer, he started running around the block and working out with his dad. He had good support there. And he lost 45 pounds during that one summer before he started high school. Mm-hmm. And it did change the way people treated him. And he had enough determination to keep the weight off. And so that's been easily 10, 12 years. And he's kept the weight off.
Some people are bullied and picked on. Some people experience self-hatred because they look at themselves in the mirror and they don't like what they see. Reagan, have you experienced either of those in your life?
Oh, I mean, I experienced absolutely both. Growing up, I had real issues with my body and my body size, and dealt with body dysmorphia and with an eating disorder. I didn't deal with a lot of bullying. I was always a little bit bigger than the rest of the kids, but I was also a really successful athlete, so I didn't get bullied a lot in school. Actually, more as an adult when I started dancing. My first dance competition, I had a judge tell me they wouldn't increase my scores till I lost 50 pounds. And I had a judge actually, like, trap me up against an elevator and tell me repeatedly that she couldn't stand to look at me. Most recently, I'm training for the Seattle Marathon right now, and on two of my training runs, I've had people get in my personal space and just either yell fat or call me a fat, you know, cuss word or whatever. So, I mean, it still happens to me.
How long does it take you to run a marathon?
Oh, so this is my first one.
Okay.
I anticipate that it will take between 7 and 8 hours. I'm not going for speed at all. I have my dance company that I run and dance in, and so even though I do these, like, other things outside of dance, I try to make sure I don't get injured, so I'll be basically walking this, but I want to do it across the finish line, get the medal and the t-shirt, and have done it.
And I want to get back to something that you said early in the conversation, that being fat is not unhealthy. That sounds counterintuitive, so how can that be?
So here's the thing. Weight and health are two different things. And that's where we're getting tripped up here. I mean, there's a lot of research on this. There's Way et al. There's the Cooper Institute Longitudinal Studies, the largest database of human fitness. And their quote is, we studied this from lots of angles in women and in men, and we find it's not the obesity, it's the fitness. There's Matheson et al. That found that people who kept the same habits had roughly the same health outcomes regardless of size. And so what we're saying is, let's make this discussion based on research. Even if weight loss would make people healthier, the truth is, we don't know how to get it done.
Well, let me stop you there because we have to take a break. I'll let you finish on the other side. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Mecklenburg Stormwater Services, providing volunteer opportunities for residents to improve neighborhood streams through the Adopt a Stream and Storm Drain marking programs. Info at stormwater.charmec.org. Well, several years ago, we met a man named August Turok, a former executive at MTV and at A&E. He'd also run two Raleigh-based tech companies, and we spoke to him about ways to improve our economy or move it out of its slump through something he called conscious capitalism, which involves concepts he learned from Trappist monks. Well, now he's expanded on what he learned from them about running a business based on service and selflessness, and he'll be back tomorrow to talk about bringing values and principles back to business. That's coming up tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. closes diplomatic posts across North Africa and the Middle East and issues a worldwide travel alert assessing the national security threat from al-Qaeda affiliates.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are talking about something called fat activism with a fat activist blogger, writes the blog danceswithfat.com, Reagan Chastain, who's on the phone with us from Los Angeles. And I want to make sure that you're actually still there, Reagan, because we seem to be having a phone problem on our other lines. Are you still there?
I am here. Can
Great.
You hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Also in our studio, Dr. Scott Gordon, the chair of the Department of Kinesiology at UNC Charlotte, an exercise physiologist, and Michael Buchanan, author and screenwriter of a movie called The Fat Boy Chronicles. I interrupted you in the middle of a thought, Reagan, about the difference in being obese versus being fit. And you can be fat and fit at the same time, you say.
Correct. What I was saying was that weight loss simply doesn't meet the requirements of evidence-based medicine. There just aren't any studies where fat people got thin and stayed thin long-term. And there aren't any studies where they tested people who had lost weight and kept it off long-term and they were healthier than they would have been. Those studies just haven't been done, basically because there aren't enough people who have lost weight and kept it off.
Okay.
And so it's like saying people who have bad knees would be better off if they could fly, because that'll take the pressure off your knees. Well, that's true. But if we don't know how to make them fly, we don't tell them to jump off their garage and flap their arms real hard, you know, because it'll be so great if they can get it done.
Right.
And so what we say at Health at Every Size is, since we don't have proof that weight loss would make us healthier, and we don't have any reason to believe that it will do anything but make us gain weight in the long term, we would prefer to use an evidence-based method of health, which is to practice healthy habits.
Now, I know you're not a medical doctor, Dr. Gordon, but you are an exercise physiologist. Is it possible to eat all the right foods in the right amounts and exercise, appropriate exercise, and still be overweight? Because your metabolism is such that it just doesn't work like everybody else.
The answer, in general, you do see studies where it is hard to take off the weight or hard to keep off the weight. Most of those fail because of bad diets and improper adherence to lifestyle change. But that doesn't mean it's easy, and it doesn't mean that everyone's going to be able to do it. So Reagan is correct that long-term studies of weight loss, it is hard to keep the weight off, and so maybe we have to find other mechanisms by physical activity.
And so if you are 5'3 and 300 pounds, but you exercise regularly and mm-hmm. you eat what people would think to be a normal, healthy diet, the right foods in the right mm-hmm. amounts, and you're still 300 pounds, can you be fit?
You can be fitter than what you would be if you weren't exercising and you weren't having a proper diet. The problem here is that I disagree with Reagan about the statistics and the data. There are a lot of data out there that showing that obesity, especially the level 2 and level 3 obesity, which above a BMI of a body mass index of 35 mm-hmm. or 40, that's basically 10% of our population. No matter how much you exercise or have a proper diet, even if it's not low calorie, it's a good diet, you're still going to be unhealthier than those people who have a BMI that are lower. So it's good if you're exercising, but you still aren't going to be as healthy as those people who are leaner. The data are overwhelming in that respect. Now, so the dangers are, it's not – we have to balance, bullying and fat discrimination are absolutely unacceptable. There's no doubt about it. But the dangers are, we have to be careful when you speak to the general public about this – is we don't want people to become complacent and say it's okay. So it's a dangerous message to say, oh, you can have a BMI of 40 or over and be as fit as someone who is lean. It just is not true.
Michael, we're going to talk about bullying throughout the course of this program because that is a lot of the problem that particularly young people face. And you heard what Reagan said about people at her – adults said to her, judges said to her at dance competitions, I can't stand to look at you. How pervasive, at least in the school setting, is prejudice and bullying against young fat people?
It's the number one reason a kid is bullied by 60% more than any other kid in the school. The overweight kid is the most bullied kid. And it affects, I think one of the issues or one of the problems that I've seen in dealing with being kind of pushed into obesity world and bullying world and having been a former teacher is the connection between bullying and obesity and school performance. All of those things are so interwoven. But right now it seems to be obesity world, people that are dealing with that, people dealing with bullying, and in the test-taking people that are focused on that issue. But yet all three of them work together for school safety, school climate, and dropout rates and school performance are all tied into these other issues. But I would like to piggyback on what the doctor said, that a lot of this, what Doug went through and a lot of people that do keep the weight off, it is a lifestyle change. If you think that you're going to buy into some quick weight loss program, then the chances are it's going to be a quick weight gain program on the back end of it. And I agree with him to say that you can be overweight and healthy. That is true. But to kind of toss that message out there, I think, rationalizes some things and perhaps enables some people to keep with the status quo in their life. And so activities and things like that are definitely what we need to do. But there's every study that I've read and talked with doctors about say that the connection between obesity, overweight, and heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure are totally there. And it's impacting our children at a very high rate. That one quick thing, I had an aunt who smoked for 70 years, and she lived to be 95. But I would not use that as an example to point out to young kids that, oh, if you smoke, it's probably okay. I would probably point out the examples of my other uncles who died directly because of smoking.
Reagan, you say that habits are a much better indicator of health than size. So explain that and talk about your own personal habits for a second.
Sure. First of all, when I say habits are a much better indicator of health than size, I'm looking at studies like Way et al., Matheson et al., the Cooper Institute longitudinal studies, large-scale studies that found that people who had similar habits had similar health outcomes regardless of size. One of the things we have to look at is the difference between correlation and causation. Correlation is when two things happen at the same time. Causation is when we know that one thing actually causes the other to happen. And what we have with weight and health is correlation. Peter Meaning out of Columbia found that all the diseases that are correlated with obesity are also correlated with being under a high degree of stress for a long period of time, like, for example, the stress of constant stigma and bullying. And so when you look at people in that class 2 and class 3 obesity range, as the doctor was discussing, those people are also subject to a tremendous amount more discrimination than other people.
So are you saying that being discriminated against because you're fat and because people are constantly haranguing you, that could lead to high blood pressure, that could lead to heart problems, that could lead to type 2 diabetes?
They're correlated with the same thing. So they're correlated with weight and they're also correlated with stress. And so what I'm saying is that studies find that being shamed and stigmatized is bad for your health. Munich found in a separate study that people who were concerned about their weight had more mental and physical illnesses than people who were fine with their size, regardless of their size. So what I'm saying is, if we took weight out of the health discussion and we just focused on providing options for healthy foods and for safe movement options that people could choose, and we stopped telling people that the body they live in 100% of the time is wrong and a sign of their moral failing and lack of willpower and whatever else we bully them about, if we just focused on health, we would probably have a much healthier population.
You call this the Galileo issue because during his time, everybody knew that the sun revolved around the earth. Of course, they were wrong. And now you say everyone knows that fat is unhealthy. So despite statements to the contrary, statements that can be fully supported by the facts, you say, they're considered heretical to say that fat is healthy. What's the evidence for what you're saying? I mean, seriously, where is the evidence that says fat is healthy?
Okay, so first, I want to be really clear that I'm not saying fat is healthy. I'm saying fat is a body size, and it is separate from health. There are healthy and unhealthy people of every size. And these diseases, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, they're not just fat people diseases. Thin people get them as well. Mm-hmm. And so being thin can neither be a sure preventative nor a sure cure.
Okay, let's talk about, doctor, let me bring this in, because she's right. Skinny people can have hypertension. Skinny people mm-hmm. can have heart disease. Skinny people can have diabetes. Mm-hmm. What are the other diseases that we associate with being overweight?
Well, the primary, the metabolic syndrome, you know, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, sleep apnea, okay. hypertension, arthritis.
Skinny people can have all of those things.
They can have all of those things, but in general, most of those things are at a lower incidence with people who are lean versus people who are obese.
How do we know that being obese or overweight or being fat, to use her word, how do we know that that leads to these diseases more often than just being circumstantially affected by it when you're skinny?
Well, there are a lot of studies that even if they're just short-term weight loss studies, you see improvement of these factors. Now, it's true you can't rule out that it may be another factor besides loss of weight, okay? But there, for instance, just exercising itself, even independent of weight loss, will improve a lot of these factors. So maybe the associated weight loss will make it look like the weight loss itself is causing the improvement. However, she's right about correlational studies and cause and effect, but she used her own example that there's correlations of people who get bullied, that causes higher anxiety and depression and higher prevalence of obesity.
You're not a medical doctor, but could she be right that we are simply saying that things are caused by being fat when it's just a coincidence mm-hmm. that things are happening at the same time and they're not really related?
Well, it's possible, but improbable. The data, after a while, when the data accumulate enough, and you have enough people showing the same thing, mm-hmm. that cause and effect starts to take a little bit more of a foothold than just one study with a correlation. And most of these studies will actually try to tease out other cofactors that are independent of obesity.
Leslie on Facebook writes, Michael, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, if I could jump in there on mm-hmm. The fact that, like, I work with a lot of doctors here in Atlanta about the obesity issue. And when they have kids that are 9 years old coming into the ER because of a stroke or heart problems or whatever, the vast majority of the time they're overweight kids. And so, yes, I will agree with everybody that says the bullying issue for overweight kids creates stress in their life. But it does not give them a fatty liver. It does not make this generation the first one that will have a shorter lifespan probably than their parents. And so I think there's enough studies and enough people that I've talked with to understand and to be totally convinced that, yes, you can be healthy and be overweight, but the chances are better that you're going to be healthy if you lose the weight, and whatever the motivation may be.
Leslie on Facebook writes, my problem was diabetes. I was fat and in terrible condition. I lost 88 pounds and completely corrected my diabetes and reduced many medications. How do fat activists deal with the obvious diseases that are directly related to weight? Reagan?
Once again, I imagine that Leslie undertook some behavior changes, which resulted in a change in health and a change in weight. According to the studies that exist, there's about a 95% chance that within 5 years, Leslie's going to gain her weight back, regardless of if she continues the habits that lost the weight. That's simply the research that exists, which is kind of why I say this is a Galileo issue. There's this idea everybody can lose weight if they just try hard enough, but it's simply not what the research says. There are tons of studies that show that, again, habits influence health. Right. And so when somebody undertakes a walking program and starts walking 30 minutes a day, they experience tremendous health benefits, but typically no weight loss. Or if they do experience weight loss, it's short term and the weight comes back. Mm. I do want to go back and discuss that idea that this generation of kids is not going to live as long as the previous generation. The scientists who said that were specific that those were what they called, I'm quoting here, back of the envelope calculation. So that's not something that is based in statistical fact. And again, I think that you are much better off to teach healthy habits and to make healthy options available than you are to just keep telling people, change your body size and let's hope that that makes you healthier.
On Reagan's blog, danceswithfat.com, she writes about, and she's already talked about this a little bit on the program, health at every size, which she says is about opting out of a social construct perpetuated by a $60 billion a year diet industry that takes our money to solve a problem that nobody has proven is valid with a solution that nobody has proven is effective or even possible. Now, it is a known fact that people who get on these diets, the ones that you see on TV, have success and then gain the weight back almost in every case. So does she have a point there?
She has a point. It's very hard to find studies where there are long-term weight loss that people keep off. However,
and is that because perhaps each of us has an ideal weight that our body wants to reach, and it may be 350 pounds?
There is a genetic component, mm-hmm. for sure, that we each have sort of what we call a set point, and there are some people, there's a theory out there called the thrifty gene hypothesis that we are really good at storing fat for emergency use, mm-hmm. That come from our Paleolithic ancestors.
Right.
However, what she's talking about, these weight loss studies, it's a separate factor compared to what we're talking about with obesity for health. You know, there truly are studies where it's hard to keep it off. But there are people who make it happen, and they may not go from a BMI of 40 to a BMI of 25. That may be physiologically impossible, but they can go from a BMI of 40 to below 35 and maybe around 30 if with long-term lifestyle changes. And it does happen. And
are they healthier for having done it?
And they are healthier for having done it.
Michael, this book and movie that you've done about this young boy who was fat and was discriminated against, picked on, bullied. Does the American Medical Association's labeling of obesity as a disease aggravate that problem?
It very well could for kids in schools that just don't quite get it. I think to bring more attention to the problem is going to be helpful in the long run, because one of the things that I've learned also, like I'm down here in Georgia, but I would be willing to bet it's consistent across the nation. 75% of parents who have overweight or obese kids do not think their child is overweight or obese. And so many times behavior is rationalized or whatever it might be. They just don't, you know, you can't solve a problem or even think about doing something different if you don't at first recognize that something might be out of order.
But could this classification, aside from being bullied by your peers, could it lead to discrimination from teachers, from insurance providers, from others? Because now you are classified as somebody with a disease.
Right. Well, perhaps classifying it as a disease could help with the insurance problem. Before it was, and I agree with Reagan on many points about the self-esteem issue and how kids should not be bullied because of their size, because a kid a lot of times is very much enabled by factors around him that they can or cannot control, usually cannot. But I think schools and all that have already recognized this problem. I think to call it obesity a disease is going to hopefully help the larger population in the U.S. understand that, wow, this really is something we need to do something about.
The National Association for the Advancement of Fat Acceptance, there really is an organization called that, has something to say about discrimination for fat people, which I'll share you with, and I want to get your reactions to what they have to say about it in just a moment. We have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting I Love Lucy live on stage. The Annex of America's favorite foursome, Lucy, Ricky, Fred, and Ethel, tomorrow through the 18th in the Knight Theater. Tickets at 704-372-1000. How will they do it in black and white? That's what I want to know. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, Amazon's Jeff Bezos is buying the Washington Post. He's keeping the paper's current leadership for now, but promises changes ahead. And Diane Rehm and her guests talk about a new era for print journalism, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, well, now's the time at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. That'll get you through Facebook and Twitter and emails and whatnot, or 704-926-WFAE or 800-603-WFAE, and we are coming right back.
If you're like most people, you rely on a wide variety of sources for the news of the day. I'm John Hockenberry, and on The Takeaway, we draw on our partners, the New York Times, the WGBH Boston Public Radio folks, and experts from around the country. so you can better understand your world. Listen to all the sources each weekday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 2 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about fat activism with a fat activist blogger with danceswithfat.com is the name of Reagan Chastain's blog. She joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Dr. Scott Gordon's in our studio, the chair of the Department of Kinesiology at UNC Charlotte, an exercise physiologist, and Michael Buchanan, an author and screenwriter responsible for the Fat Boy Chronicles, a film we talked about several years ago on this program, which is now available on Netflix. The National Association for the Advancement of Fat Acceptance says that discrimination towards fat people in the workplace, education system, and healthcare system has been clearly documented and is growing rapidly. Michael, Reagan, do you see evidence of that? Reagan, let me begin with you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the research out of Yale showed clearly that fat women were hired less often and paid less than thin counterparts. Discrimination in the doctor's office is absolutely, I think, the most challenging issue facing people, and could actually be part of why we have, you know, they show more health problems as people get fatter, because doctors give us less respect. The Yale research found that over 50% of doctors found their fat patients to be awkward, ugly, weak-willed, and unlikely to comply. And so the doctors gave them less time and less respect.
Actually, the National Association for the Advancement of Fat Acceptance says that doctors view obese patients often as lazy, lacking in self-control, non-compliant, unintelligent, weak-willed, and dishonest.
Absolutely. There's also the issue of no matter what you go in with, they diagnose you as fat. I've been prescribed weight loss for a broken toe, a separated shoulder, and strep throat. Which kind of goes back to the counts of prevalence. If you take group A and you test them early and often for a disease, let's say type 2 diabetes, and you take group B and you never test them, and if they present with the symptoms of type 2 diabetes, you say, no, people like you don't get it, then it's not like a big shocker that group A has a higher disease incidence.
Michael, let me get your
Michael,
let me get your take on the National Association for the Advancement of Fat Acceptance and what they have to say about discrimination.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, when I talk to schools all around the nation and about the issues and about the book and movie and all that stuff, and so many times the kids who will come up after the talk are the kids that are overweight and they want to talk about being bullied in school by the other kids. And I think that is kind of a consequence of this intense focus on this issue, is all of a sudden it makes the other kids go, oh my gosh, Johnny over there or Becky is fat. And they may not have noticed that before. I think they probably did, but now there's maybe even more on it. But also the quiet kid, the kid who's potentially bullied because of his weight, a lot of times, or they bullied for whatever reason, they're not going to be the one to offer up much in class. And so they don't want anybody to notice them. I've taught school long enough to know that I'm retired now, but the kid who's the overweight kid tries to be invisible many times in class, because they don't want to take the chance of missing the answer. And in the hallway afterwards, everybody go, oh, God, I can't believe you're stupid. I can't believe you said that. And so there, many times, if they could just go to school and have nobody notice them, they would be thrilled.
And I read, I think it may be something from your film, I can't remember, that a lot of times overweight young people sit in the back of the room because they don't want to be taunted for somebody not being able to see the blackboard because they're too big to see the blackboard through.
Right, yeah. I mean, any way that they can not draw attention to themselves, they think helps them in the long run. And it's very sad and it's very unfortunate.
So, Reagan, you've said it's okay to be fat and that health is a very personal thing and each person gets to choose how highly they want to prioritize their health and the path they take to get there. And all that sounds very American because we're an individualistic country and we have the right, as you say in your blog, we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and happiness is up to the individual. But doesn't being fat also become a societal problem in that there are a host of healthcare consequences that are increasing the rising burden of healthcare costs to society at large?
So the Congressional Budget Office did an independent nonpartisan study and found that fat people were not the cause of the huge increases in healthcare. But even if we were, people are allowed to do all kinds of things that don't prioritize their health. They're allowed to be professional bull riders. They're allowed to be X Games athletes. They're allowed to ski down hills that have big trees in the way. And we pay for all that. Right, people are allowed to prioritize their health. And so this idea that, oh, well, if you have a fat body, I know that you're costing society, but if you have a thin body, we assume that your behaviors are healthy and you're very active and you have no health problems, is really just thinly veiled bigotry at the end of the day. Everybody gets to prioritize and make choices for their own health, and that's a good thing, because otherwise, who gets to choose? Like, does a vegan get to say that we all have to be vegan because that would be the healthiest and therefore less costly option? Or does a person who does paleo get to say we all have to do paleo? And so at the end of the day, people get to choose how highly they prioritize their health and the path they take to get there.
Well, let me bring somebody into this conversation. Lawrence is joining us by phone. Lawrence, you talk about eating a plant-based diet. She just mentioned vegans. Talk to me.
Well, Mike, I'd like to make a comment on a number of things here, but let's address that. A vegan diet is the healthiest diet. That's been shown over and over again. But I'm not going to dictate to Megan or have it legislated that that's going to be the case, because everyone, you know, is allowed to do whatever they want to do as far as their own health. But, you know, as far as health is concerned, I don't know many, 70 or 80-year-old 300-pound people, okay? And I know nothing about Megan's health. I got into this conversation late. Mm. But
Let's just say that she's healthy. But, Reagan, what about that? What about not seeing a lot of 70- or 80-year-old overweight people?
Actually, there are plenty of older overweight people. And the other thing to realize is that most people die of wasting diseases. And so many studies have found that at a certain age, fat becomes protective, right? Because you just have more reserves if you get cancer and you have to do chemo. There's a thing called the obesity paradox, that fat people get more heart attacks, but we survive them more. Hmm. And so there are some protective things, especially as you get older, to being fat. And most people, again, die of wasting diseases, so they die much thinner than they were at, say, 55.
Lawrence, thank you for your call. Dr. Gordon?
Well, again, she's right. When you get to a certain age, let's say your 70s and 80s, having a little bit more body weight is actually protective.
Hmm.
But you have to remember, when you talk about aging studies, by the time you get to your 70s and 80s, a lot of people have already passed on. And so the morbidly obese population is more likely to die before that time. And what you've weeded out is the people who are, quote unquote, healthy, low levels of obesity, maybe lower BMI, but still in the obese category. And there's some evidence that may be okay. It certainly is a lot better than morbidly obese. And the morbidly obese people, there's no doubt, die younger.
Well, let's come back to something here, because people are carrying around more weight today in America than ever before. I do not recall seeing a lot of fat children when I was a child. There just weren't a lot of them. And today there are.
Right.
There are a lot of overweight. What term should I use, Reagan, so I'm not insulting or being a bully?
I personally would use fat. You could also use people of size or kids of size.
There are a lot of people of size, adults, walking around the streets of America today, more so than ever before. Is there empirical evidence anywhere that says general health is suffering as a result?
As a direct result of obesity?
Yes.
There is a lot of evidence to show associations, and Reagan is correct, and sometimes it's hard to tease out. But when you tease out a lot of these other factors, a lot of times obesity at the higher levels can itself be one of the independent factors. But physical activity, like Reagan says, proper diet, like Reagan says, is also very important. So I do not want to lose that message.
And Michael, you wanted to chime in here, I know.
Yeah, I mean, something Reagan said, adults can choose the lifestyle that they want to live. That is very much correct, and no problem with that. But how do we deal with the children? Those are the ones that are at the mercy of the food industry, at the mercy of TV commercials, whatever it might be, lunches in schools and things like that. I think that's going down the wrong path to say adults can choose what they want to do and never mention what's happening around our children, to the fact that there are so many more, that you acknowledge, Mike, that there are so many more overweight kids nowadays. And when they all become adults, I cannot see for the life of me how that is not going to create a problem. You know, we don't have a growing number of bull riders, but we do have a growing number of obese and overweight children, which is going to be many more overweight adults. And all the problems inherent with that.
The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta says that healthcare costs are bigger for those who are obese, and that obesity-related conditions include heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and some cancers. Reagan, are they just making this up?
No, it goes back to correlation causation. If you are fat and you get sick, they assume it's because you are fat and don't look at other things. There's a couple things to look at here. One is that there are medical conditions that cause people to become fatter. There are also psychotropic drugs that cause people to gain weight that are being prescribed much more regularly. Hmm. And so, again, weight loss, we don't have a way to do that. I mean, we simply don't have a safe way that results in long-term weight loss for even a majority of people in studies. I mean, Weight Watchers heralded a study that showed that their average participant maintains a 5-pound weight loss over 2 years. That, I mean, for most people, they could exfoliate and get that done. They don't need to do Weight Watchers and pay, you know, however many thousands of dollars to do that. And so I think, again, and going back to what he was saying about kids and health, I am for healthy kids. I am for giving kids options for affordable, healthy food and for safe movement options that they enjoy. But I don't think it's just for fat kids. I think all kids deserve that. And I think that making this about kids' weight does a disservice to fat kids because it stigmatizes their bodies and it tells them that if their healthy habits don't make them thin, then they're not working, which leads to them quitting. And it does a disservice to thin kids because it gives them the misinformation that they're healthy simply because they're thin and regardless of their habits. And that's also not what a study shows.
Let me share some more comments. Jay Scott, writing on Facebook, says, I think a huge issue when we try to lose weight is the boxes in which our friends put us. For many years, I've been the big guy in my circle. As I've lost weight and become actually slimmer than a couple of my friends, I've noticed that some of them have become distant or seem to be unable to stop treating me like the guy who eats everything. I'll never be skinny, but neither do I forever want to be thought of as the king of bacon. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on that or not. Lisa on Facebook says, I agree with Reagan that we should not be assessed with a specific size or shape body. We are all different. However, I do feel that we need to move the focus to prevention, especially in children and in schools. Our society needs to learn how to eat healthier and exercise appropriately at a very young age. That will ultimately lead to a healthy body weight that one can maintain his or her entire life. I would have to argue that statistically, most obese people are not healthy. As a nation, we're not moving enough, and we are consuming far too much processed food, unhealthy fats and refined sugars, which has led to this obesity epidemic and the diseases that are associated with obesity. I'm also a teacher, and as your author mentioned, my obese students have horrible diets, and it definitely affects their performance in school. Doctor,
let me chime in on the primary prevention is what she just mentioned, and I wholeheartedly agree. Lifestyle choices at a young age and throughout life, one of the important things about proper diet, exercise, you can have a lifelong change that starts early in life and prevent obesity from happening to begin with, or prevent morbid obesity or severe obesity from happening. Mm-hmm. So it's important to start early on. Unfortunately, our medical industry tends to treat things on the back end. You wait till someone is sick, or you wait till someone's obese, and then you try to then get rid of that disease. And now the AMA is calling obesity a disease. It's a lot harder to lose weight after you've gained it than to prevent it in the first place.
And there are kids are at a disadvantage today because they are being fed a lot of processed food, a lot of fat food, a lot of food laden with fats and sugars. It's not their fault. Right. They're giving it by their parents. Up until recently, it was served in the school cafeterias. What did you witness as a teacher and as a producer of this documentary or this film, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I mean, when I was a teacher, you know, you don't think about it. Like when I first started teaching, you know, that you didn't realize what school lunches were doing to our kids because it's cheap and it's all that kind of stuff. But over time and looking back now, I'm like, wow, I cannot believe that that was being allowed. And one thing I would like to say about the kids is I work with the Strong for Life folks here at Emory University in children's healthcare, And they say we need to redefine happy for kids. I mean, well, when I was growing up, happy was eating a McDonald's and whatever it might be, you know, a Happy Meal and all these things that are advertised nonstop. And happy needs to be for a five-year-old eating a banana and an apple and walking around the block with grandpa and things like that. And then once that behavior is set in a kid, then it's much easier for them to not, you know, have to worry about weight later on.
I only have a minute left, but Reagan, you've written about people who are calling for accommodation. They're asking public space providers for armless chairs. You say that airlines need to find a way to more easily provide a second seat for fat people and zero out the extra cost. And you believe that this isn't asking for anything special or special treatment. It's not unlike people in the civil rights movement and the gay rights movement demanding equal rights. But if you're asking the airline to give you a second seat for free, isn't that special treatment?
I don't think so. I think it's asking for what everyone else has. If you can go on an airline, you can sit in a seat comfortably, and you pay for the passage. If you go on an airline and you can't get a seat comfortably and you're asking for what everyone else has, that's not something special. You know, the airline tries to get it both ways. When you require more room than one seat, they say, oh, you know, you have to pay extra because you're paying for the space. Mm-hmm. But when they bump you off the seat, they say, oh, you're not paying for space. You're paying for passage back and forth.
Okay.
And so, well, I don't think they can have it both ways.
I have to stop you, but you can read more about these thoughts that Reagan Chastain has about being fat on her blog, danceswithfat.com. Also with us, Dr. Scott Gordon, chair of the Department of Kinesiology at UNC Charlotte, and Michael Buchanan, author and screenwriter of The Fat Boy Chronicles, among other books and films. Thank you all for the hour. I appreciate it.